Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So you watch those insufferable self-congratulatory award shows like the Oscars.
Amy. Yeah, and the Emmys, sometimes the Tonys.
Sure. People's Choice.
People's Choice Award. That's a good one.
Nickelodeon.
I don't watch that one.
Oscars.
MTV Awards.
The Oscars.
Yeah.
You watch the Oscars.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. You were one of the few that did last year. So few, in fact, that the Oscars announced yesterday they're changing the program to try and
It goes on forever. You could drive
more relevant.
You could drive to St. Louis, and the Oscars program is still not over.
Well, that's one issue they addressed. 24 competitive awards, where the general public only cares about a few, best actor, best actress. And again, I renew my call, which they did not address, to eliminate gender-specific categories.
Oh, yeah.
There's no such thing as gender anymore. And it would be nice if Hollywood would stop being so rigidly conservative when it comes to gender. Here's the big one. The big one is there are going to be three kinds of best movie, best animated feature, best picture, and now outstanding achievement in popular film.
Which means the blockbuster of the year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Casting aside artistic integrity for the filthy dollar. Ooh. Isn't that unfortunate? Mark Stein had a great riff on Stuart Varney yesterday about this announcement and the hypocrisy of Hollywood that it exposes.
And as you said, Stuart, it's the dishonor. For 11 and a half months of the year, the motion picture business now is like Ant-Man 3, Iron Man 7, Cardboard Man 12, Franchise Man 53. And then for like 3 weeks before the Oscars, it's all suddenly like Oscar bait chick flits, flicks, produced by Harvey Weinstein, oddly enough. And they pretend they're great artists. So that tells the sobering story of a woman growing up in transphobic Manitoba. And you think, wait a minute, I never saw this film. It was just Franchise Man 57 when I was at the multiplex. That's all. So that's the thing. It's actually the contradiction between who they pretend to be and what this business model is.
Yeah, Stein even cracked himself up there with his the story of living in transphobic Manitoba that comes out 3 weeks before the Oscars, which is, he's exactly right. He nails it. I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, it's it breaks from tradition. The best picture is the best picture, and then you can compare best pictures over the many, many years. On the other hand, I don't know. I guess it's more honest. And this way, Black Panther will get an Academy Award.
That is what I was thinking when I heard that. Because remember Oscar's So White? Remember that whole thing when not one African-American was nominated in any top category? Because it just happened. It was that year. You know, some years you'll have a lot of African-Americans nominated. So,
happened?
The big one will be, you're right, will be Black Panther.
What happened that year, the Oscars So White year, is, oh my gosh, could it be that the white liberals in charge of Hollywood are racist? Heavens.
No.
Oh, we better cover our tracks like we do in every other aspect of in our lives where we, kind of behave in one way for the purposes of separating ourselves from the others, really was the point here. I mean, you see it the same thing in Chicago. Hey, give those people in those neighborhoods some stuff, so they don't come to my neighborhood. That's liberalism. That's really what it is. And so that Oscar thing was about the same thing. But Yeah. So
and then also the
now we'll have these new categories. To
yeah, debate. And during the commercial breaks, they're going to hand out some technical awards instead of doing it, you know, during
yeah,
the
TV.
Show.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, but what and also too best animated feature.
Oh,
because you got all these Pixar movies that need yeah. Academy Awards too.
Well, that's the that's their children's movies. I mean, that's their bread and butter. That's it's. I love animated films if they're well done. What's your favorite one? How to Train Your Dragon or How to Train Your Dragon 2?
Yeah.
That movie's actually about big government. I love that movie.
That's I like The Incredibles. I also liked Cardboard Man 57, to borrow from Mark Stein.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We told you about the grandma in Houston who shot the masturbating cyclist yesterday.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is he dead?
He's not. He's expected to survive. And Gene Wilson.
I hope he put some pants on.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to see that.
And perhaps you should stop trying to break into people's homes as well. Gene Wilson is the grandma in question. And she explained to a local television station what happened.
Gene Wilson remembers every moment from start to finish.
Pants gapped open, and it just playing with itself, you know.
Sure.
And I said, get away from me, get away from me. I said, leave my house. Don't come up to my door. And that's where he stepped at. That's the last place he stepped. I said, you pull my...
Those are his footsteps,
yes,
right,
ma'am?
There.
I said, you reach for my door, I'm going to shoot you.
And,
a masturbating bicycle burglar.
Yeah. He really had his hands full.
Ew.
Thank you very much.
Did she shoot him in the naughty bits?
She did not stomach. She aimed a little high.
Oh.
You know,
so get that away from me. Bam, bam.
You touch that door handle, I'm going to shoot you.
And he touched the door handle.
And she kept her word. But there's a reason, too. I mean, it's not all fun and games here. This is,
this is very serious.
Well, it's an elderly woman defending herself. Also, kids in the home.
Oh.
And that's what she was afraid of, she explained.
He could have hurt my kids. And that's all I got.
Her kids are her disabled grandson she cares for, her 11-year-old great-granddaughter who was inside. Johnson survived. He remains hospitalized from the bullet wound to his stomach. Wilson protected her family, but she takes no pleasure in what happened. She's grateful that her family is safe and that no one died, including the man she says she was forced to shoot.
And thank you, Jesus. Thank you.
Well, it was a funny story. Now it's really
exactly.
Sad.
Now aren't you upset that you were laughing at her?
No, I mean, she's taking care of a disabled grandchild.
Grandson and 11-year-old great-grandchild. Wow. Interesting. She takes no pleasure in it. But, of course, the cyclist was taking pleasure in it right up until he got shot. Good.
Good for her. So she doesn't want to be called a hero. She just wants to move on.
Well, and she's happy everybody's safe, even the assailant. Good grandma with a gun.
There you go.
Good grandma with a gun. We're going to talk a little bit about that with John Lott. Not about shooting masturbating cyclists specifically.
Masturbating.
But we're not going to exclude
burglar.
That. Because it just interestingly, so thinking about this story and somebody like it, Wall Street Journal spread front page yesterday, the new litmus test for Democrats, gun control.
Oh.
You got to be on board with the gun banners in addition to all of the other agenda points of the Democrat Socialists if you want to be ascendant in the 21st century Democrat Socialist Party. So just interesting. We'll get John Lott's take. But good for Grandma Jean and a message to all you masturbating cyclists / burglars.
It's really hurting, by the way, two Democrat candidates in Minnesota. In fact, a leading candidate who's also the Attorney General, Lori Swanson, who has a grade from the NRA, and it is really hurting her ahead of the primary next week in Minnesota. As you mentioned, people
there
are attacking her because she actually has a rating from the NRA, not necessarily an endorsement, but it's really dragging her down in the polls right now.
I mean, you can participate in a an Islamic radicalization compound where you're training child killers, that's fine.
Yeah, that, yeah.
But I mean, defending yourself from an assailant in your home, hey, you know, being a gun owner, a law-abiding gun owner, being, I mean, especially in Minnesota, being a sportsman or sportswoman, yeah. No, that's a bridge too far. Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. Look, we've just got two different ideas about what America is. We'll talk about that when freedom returns at 5.
Dan and Amy, we were talking about the big story. Houston great-grandmother shoots masturbating cyclist. He's a repeat felon, by the way.
What's his last name or what's his first name? Because I want to see his mugshot.
His first name is Clarence. I think Tony from Palos Heights has a handle on his last name. Tony, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, good morning, Dan and Amy. I just thought it was interesting that his last name is Johnson.
Why is that interesting?
And if I were to guess, I thought his first name might be Richard.
Yes. Yes.
Oh.
Thanks for the call, Tony. Appreciate that.
I see what you did there.
There's a...
He's 38 years old, and he went into surgery yesterday. Mm-hmm. He's going to be okay.
To have his hand removed from his... last name.
One time he was arrested for running around naked around another nearby town.
Mm-hmm. He's not the most subtle of criminals, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to break in. You shouldn't have your attention divided is my point.
Yeah. Okay. He's a nudist. I mean, that's what he is. He runs around naked.
All right.
Okay.
Well, he ran into the wrong great-grandma.
He sure did.
This week in Houston. So good for her. All right. On to more heady matters.
Oh, Dan, I see what you did there.
Thank you very much. New Pew Research on... That's not intended to be a pun.
Something else.
No. A survey done by Pew Research, 3,000 voters took part in a panel... asking them about the 2016 election and where they are now in 2018, their feelings about Trump. The predicate question here being, are you as enthusiastic about Trump as you were when you voted for him in 2016? And to try and get a read, are you going to be enthusiastic enough to come out and support those Trump needs on the Hill, i.e. members of Congress, in November? Are you still with Trump and you understand that if you want to stay with him and you want him to succeed and you want him to continue doing what he's doing, it's more likely he'll be able to do that with Republican majorities than Democrats in charge, clearly. So the researchers asked the participants to rate their feelings about Trump on a 0 to 100 scale. About 6 in 10 of those who voted for Trump in 16, the enthusiasts, they're called, mm-hmm. had warm feelings toward him all along, going back to the primaries in the spring, and continue to feel warmly toward him. So is the Trump coalition sticking together? Can they be motivated and deployed in November for members of Congress or candidates for Congress? Another group making up just over 2 in 10 Trump voters were the converts. They were chilly toward Trump during the primaries, but warm to him once he became the nominee and have remained warm ever since. Okay, so the 8 in 10 Trump voters are holding, essentially. But then there's a couple of problem areas. And remember, yes, these are marginal, but in close races, which a lot of swing races are expected to be, you know, the margins matter. About 1 in 8 people who voted for Trump in 2016 fall into the category of skeptics. You know, that's the label given. They had chilly feelings toward Trump during the primaries, warm term during the general election, you know, not Hillary, Supreme Court nominees, whatever was the motivating factor to get over their concerns, but have soured on him again. On average, they currently rate their feelings toward him at a 33 out of 100. So that's pretty chilly.
That is.
And then a final smaller group, the disillusioned, had warm feelings toward Trump during the primaries and through the election, but have turned cold since he became president. They make up about 6% of Trump voters. Now you're never going to keep 100% of people who voted for you together. The question is, can you pull some people in who didn't vote for you? And can you keep a majority of your coalition together so that they can, you know, provide the vice on the political, on the other politicos to help you move your agenda? But the problem is Clinton voters, 88% gave Trump ratings in the very cold range. It's actually grown since the election. So there doesn't seem to be a lot of converts from Clinton voters. And there's a little bit of attrition among Trump voters, you know, about one in five. And, you know, that could spell trouble, and it could spell trouble particularly in the suburbs and suburban races. And this is where Democrats are looking, particularly in states that are perceived to be blue, including Illinois. They're looking at suburban Republicans as the path to majority in the House. So, but where do you fall on this Pew scale, these categories they've set up, the enthusiasts, the converts, the skeptics, or the disillusioned? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro, text line.
And let's start with you, Daniel Proft.
Well, I'm, I guess I would be a convert because I was certainly chilly toward Trump in the primary. I started out supporting Walker, then I went to Cruz when it came down to Cruz and Trump. But when it came to the general, Trump versus Hillary, no brainer.
Right.
Not a close call.
I mean, have we just gotten used to the odd behavior?
Well, I mean, sort of, to some extent, used to is he's the same guy he's been in the public eye for the last 25 years.
Right.
So it's not like he was an unknown quantity. And certainly you had your fill of who he was on the campaign trail.
Yeah.
So you can't feign surprise. In fact, not only am I a convert, I would say I'm in the pleasantly surprised category, generally speaking, right now, because I think he's actually been better than I thought he would be. I think part of that is the Democrats have moved so far hard left. They're so hysterical. They're so unhinged. They're so over the top. And I don't appreciate weaponizing the intelligence community against a particular president, against the American people's decision in that election, the way that that has been manipulated. So that pushes me more into Trump camp. Now, I've got disagreements that have been aired on this show on trade policy and some of his neo-mercantilist tendencies. But I'm pleasantly surprised by his performance as president so far. So I'm sticking with the policy agenda, and that motivates me to try and help as much as I can in this state with suburban races where Democrats could end up, the suburban races that could tip the scale for Democrats, like Roskam and Hultgren, for example.
Ugh. Well, for me, I'm definitely a convert because I thought at first when he made that comment about blood coming out of different places with Megyn Kelly calling Rosie O'Donnell, what do you call her, pig? And then the comment he made of John McCain, I just thought there's no way he's ever going to win. And I was completely wrong. But also, too, I didn't think wearing a suit in the state of Iowa was going to be a good thing. You know, he's got to dress down. But he never strayed from who he is. He is a New York businessman. And he didn't do what other politicians do, like throw on an Iowa Hawkeye jersey or a Cyclone sweatshirt to try and get the votes. He didn't pander like that.
Yeah, instead
he stuck to who he was, and he didn't. And we knew about his infidelities and his marriages. We've known that for 25 years.
But the question is, do you worry that his personality
is going
to
affect,
again, will do to majorities what Obama's policy choices did, magically turn them into minorities or super minorities? Remember, Obama turned the Democrat Party in this country into a super minority party, even though he was personally popular. And the concern is Trump remains personally popular among his base and among Republicans. But is he turning off enough that you don't have the necessary enthusiasm to generate the necessary turnout to hold the line down ballot? That matters.
So because of Trump's personality, you think there'll be a midterm blue wave in the House?
I'm not sold on the blue wave. I think it'll be uneven. I think in places, perhaps Illinois, it could be more pronounced than in a lot of other states where Democrats are counting on big pickups.
And Republicans can only afford to lose 22 seats.
right. Correct. 23 is the magic number. All right. That's right. And I think, you know, I still think it's about a 50-50 proposition. But I will tell you, going back to Ohio 12 this week, that Central Ohio district, that
they still haven't called it.
Well,
right?
They can't even count the provisional ballots for 10 days. So,
oh, okay. Those two are going to meet again in November.
Yeah, that's right.
So don't put your campaign signs away just yet.
No, that's right.
Just keep them on the lawn.
Well, Troy Balderson, he won that race narrowly. But the issue is this. If you looked at that district, Sean Trendy had a good analysis of this at Real Clear Politics. So in the rural areas, the numbers sort of held to traditional norms, including what the president did, what Trump did in that district, and he won that district by 10 points. But in the suburbs, there was significant attrition, where Republicans historically were over 50% in the suburban part of that Central Ohio district. Balderson was at 35%. Now, the candidates matter, the matchups matter, and this O'Connor, who ran against Balderson, was not Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. He presented himself as a moderate Democrat, and he was apparently, from the coverage, a pretty attractive candidate and pretty good on his feet and raised a lot of money and all those things, obviously money pouring in from all over the nation because of the importance of that race as a bellwether. So there's a whole lot of variables here that don't necessarily translate to every one of these other four or five dozen target races. But that suburban issue, suburban turnout and suburban share for Republicans is an issue. And I'm seeing it manifest itself in Illinois right now as well, in Chicago Metro. Pete in Montgomery, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Morning.
So I've always held that these nationwide polls to try to help determine local congressional races to be a little bit disingenuous.
Well, they're not helped.
No matter who.
Whoa. This is on Trump, this national poll. Now, it's interpreting it with respect to local races where you get into the back and forth. But just understand, this is about where the Trump coalition is with Trump at present.
Right. And that doesn't have anything to do with how I feel about Peter Roskam or his opponents.
Okay.
And that's where I've always found this to be a little bit off. The congressional races, senatorial races, they're generally speaking local, and that's why you can have a Republican Congress that has a 17% approval rating, yet the people in those individuals in Congress continuously get reelected, you know, to career lifetime positions they should never have had in the first place.
Well, Pete, that's right, Pete, but that works both ways. So, for example, people who voted for Obama in 2008 voted for congressional Republicans in 2010. Otherwise, they wouldn't have taken the House, and they did the same thing in 2014 after voting for Obama in 2012. Otherwise, Republicans wouldn't have taken the Senate. But that works in reverse, too. Trump voters, maybe recent converts to voting for Republicans, think blue-collar union types, maybe they voted for Trump in 2016, but they have no intention of voting for Peter Roskam or Randy Hulgren, just as an example. So I understand what you're saying, and you certainly represent a perspective that is not unique among the electorate, but there are other perspectives on the margins that matter in close races, and so it is sort of interesting to see where people are at who were with Trump in 16. Are they going to be motivated enough, stay motivated enough, and connect enough dots to get out for, just to continue this example, Roskam to help Republicans hold Congress to help advance Trump's agenda for the last 2 years of his first term?
Well, the other thing that you can look at is anybody who listens to this radio station or similar radio stations is going to get out and vote, period, regardless of who the candidate is or what their position is, because they're active and motivated, if not activists.
Yeah, that's true. Thanks for the call, Pete. Tom in Deer Park.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Concerning the national election, you've got a Democrat Party that's moving harder left every day. It's not just enough to be pro-choice, but you have to be pro-abortion. And like you mentioned earlier, stripping of gun rights. And anyone that even has a notion that they want to allow someone to have a gun, if they don't, that makes you bad. And then, of course, economic policy moving towards socialism. But as in 16, I voted third party, and Donald Trump has done some good things policy-wise, but nothing he's done has changed my opinion of him. It's only reinforced it. So I'd be voting third party again in 2020. And then our district here, we're voting for Peter Roskam. So that's kind of two different things.
Okay. All right. Thanks for the call, Tom.
And get your friends to get out to vote for Peter Roskam.
Well, and there's a lot more of that going on, particularly in places like Illinois, where both parties have destroyed any equity that existed in their brand. So you could see why people will, hey, I'm going to vote for third party, but I like Roskam or whoever, and so I'll vote based on the individual in the specific race. Ralph in Far Texas. Hey, Ralph.
Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning, sir.
You want to turn your radio down?
I like the sound of my own.
Yeah, let me move away because I was looking at the radio and you came out and answered. I wasn't sure what was going on.
We surprised you.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. No, I'm looking at the voter turnout is very fluid. It can change from day to day. And for example, the governor's meeting that Donald Trump had yesterday, it was an excellent meeting. Very professional. He looked like he had the executive look and behavior. He came across as a good businessman.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But everyone did well in that meeting, except when the meeting was over and the press was allowed to speak, all they did is just bash Trump on everything outside what was they talked about. Same old stuff. So, you know, the media is beginning to look like the enemy of the people. Instead of asking intelligent questions, they ask stupid questions time after time after time, you know, just to belittle the president.
All right, so you're sticking with Trump and down ballot to support candidates that support Trump.
As long as he's doing a good job, I support him.
You've made the switch. And it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
It's the final frontier, as you know, Amy. We're talking about 2020, a Space Force odyssey.
Spaceballs! I can't stop thinking of Mel Brooks' Spaceballs.
It's a classic, too. We've got a lot of drops to get through.
I know. I don't know if we have time. I
appreciate...
we might have to bleed into Mike Gallagher's show.
President Pence and Defense Secretary Mattis revisiting... It's the United States Space Command, the projected sixth branch of the military.
Is that going to be their theme song, that Trekkie song you just played?
I think they'll have to buy the rights to that. I don't think they can just appropriate it.
Sixth branch of the military, wow.
You got to have fun with it because it is sort of...
Well, it's an eye-rolling concept. Like, oh, we really need this. But then if you think about the bigger picture, we want to get to space and claim... the space before Russia and China, right?
We have been in space.
Sheila
Jackson Lee.
No, I know.
Yeah. I could walk you through the history.
No,
yeah,
no,
right.
I'm familiar.
Well, James Mattis, the Defense Secretary, General Mattis, he was a skeptic about this at first, but not yesterday. Here's what he had to say. You know, he's not kidding around.
Space is one of our vital national interests in the sense of our use of space, our operations in space, and it is becoming a contested warfighting domain, and we have got to adapt to that reality. It's on par with the air, land, sea, and cyberspace domains in terms of it being contested, and it's now a domain in which we must be equally prepared as all of those other domains. It's no longer a new domain, it's a domain. And we've got to be able to compete, to deter, and to win.
Yeah.
Baseball.
So he's not joking around.
No.
Now, he went on to take some questions from the audience, at which point he said this.
Having received all your letters over the years, and I've spoken to many of you, and some of you have traveled, you know, hundreds of miles to be here, I'd just like to say, get a life, will you, people?
That's good.
For more on this topic... and you know, we'll get to more of our drops
because
we're juvenile, but there's some serious matters related to this that apparently need to be discussed, so we brought a serious person on to do that. He is Colonel Cedric Layton, CNN military analyst and security consultant who has served both on the Joint Chiefs of Staff as well as the National Security Council. Colonel Layton, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
Hey, you bet, Dan. Good morning.
Good morning. So did you retweet President Trump's tweet, Space Force all the way, exclamation point?
I did not this morning.
All right. What's your assessment of what was proposed yesterday in the request for $8 billion over the next 5 years to develop the United States Space Command?
So as far as the United States Space Command is concerned, that actually makes sense. And the reason for that is we actually had a United States Space Command that existed from 1985 to 2002. When it was disbanded and the functions, most of the functions within that were placed in the already existing Air Force component, which was the Air Force Space Command, and which that continues to exist today. So that's different from actually having a separate space force. So what they're first going to do is they're going to have U.S. Space Command, which is a unified command, kind of like the European Command, Indo-Pacific Command, Special Operations Command. And then they will develop this somewhat incrementally into a Space Force, which will be a separate military service. That part is really not the necessary thing to do. What we really have to worry about is making sure that we continue to maintain what most people in the DOD and the president would call space dominance. And that's really the essential goal in this particular case.
Is there really a race to get, you know, to get a space program going before Russia and China, or do they already have one?
They already have one, Amy, and the reason this becomes important is because back in 2007, the Chinese actually blew up one of their satellites, and they did that using another satellite that had a weapon on it that could actually destroy satellites. The Chinese were sending a signal that they have the capability to destroy satellites. So this time they did they destroyed a satellite that was an old weather satellite that was no longer functional. But the signal was pretty clear. They could destroy anything out there if they weren't prevented from doing so.
What are the other priorities, national security concerns? Satellites is an obvious one. Building a Mar-a-Lago on the Red Planet, I get that. What else should we be focused on, or what else is part of thinking about America's interest in space?
So besides the Mar-a-Lago on the Red Planet, what you're really looking at is common everyday things like GPS. GPS is based completely on space satellites being up there, providing us with directional information. And now it's become so common that we have that in our phones, in our cars. You know, we use it for medical information, banking information. Basically, the entire internet is now dependent on space. So that's the primary concern, is that if we lost control of space, or you know, our assets in space were damaged or taken out, then we would lose the kind of life that we have right now, and we would be reverting back to the 1940s or 1950s. That really is the primary concern, and it could have significant impact on everything from banking to agriculture, all of the things that we're looking at, including weather forecasting. Weather forecasting would no longer be as precise as it is, although we all complain about how imprecise weather forecasting is. It would be far worse if we didn't have the satellites that we use right now.
So will this diminish the role that the Air Force plays by any chance?
It will, absolutely. The Air Force has as one of its core missions space, and in fact, they call themselves America's Aerospace Force, and a substantial portion of what the Air Force actually does is the managing and controlling of satellites. They also monitor other people's satellites and other people's systems in space. So that particular aspect of it, and the fact that they support the intelligence agencies with that kind of expertise, that would go away, presumably, under not only the U.S. Space Command, but also the future U.S. Space Force. And that, you know, is a roles and missions kind of question, as we call it in the military. military, and that could impact on our effectiveness and potentially add an extra layer of bureaucracy where we don't really need that.
So what form does the Space Force take? These are...
It's funny you saying.
Well, I mean, I think...
Because they're working on logos right now. You should see the choices.
Well, I'm thinking, you know, I'm thinking Edward James Olmos on Battlestar Galactica is what I'm thinking.
I'm thinking of him every day of my
life. I know
life.
You do for different reasons. Is it going to be drones? Or is it going to be, AI operating spacecraft?
So, yeah, it could potentially be AI, artificial intelligence, operating spacecraft. That is absolutely a possibility, but it would, presumably at least be controlled by people handling, the orbits of different space systems. That would be in U.S. Space Command and eventually in the Space Force. So those are the kinds of things that that they could do. In essence, what we're looking at is, the easiest example would be the Navy, because they protect our sea lanes of communication. In essence, all the different trading routes around the world are protected or monitored by the United States Navy. This would do the same thing for the space above our Earth, and that that would be, a considerable mission area, to say the least.
Do you think there'll be love stories that develop in space, like George Clooney and Sandra Bullock in Gravity, something like that? Is that possible? It could happen.
It's probably already happened on the International Space Station, except we don't know about it yet. At least I don't know about it yet.
Little space station baby. All right, so the Army has its star. The Marines have a globe and anchor. What do you think the Space Force logo is going to look like?
Well, I'm thinking there's going to be something extraterrestrial about it. I'm not sure exactly what it will, if it will look something like what they're proposing as part of the president's reelection campaign. But it could, include, some type of, rocket ship lunging toward the heavens. I'm not sure exactly.
How about like a lighted finger? E.T.
Well, that could be very symbolic, going all the way back to the Renaissance. It could be, there could be all kinds of possibilities there. I think it could keep a lot of imaginations going this morning.
Do you think we'll be able to find the home planet of the Green Party candidate in Ohio 12 who came from a distant planet to run for Congress? Is that a possibility?
Well, it's, all things are possible, so I wouldn't discount that. But
that is the final frontier.
When you have these kinds of possibilities, there may be, all kinds of planets will come up for all kinds of different home planets for all kinds of different people. So you never know exactly where they would be.
I mentioned you're a CNN military analyst. Who asks dumber questions, me or Don Lemon?
Damn.
I have a great time with both of you.
Yes, okay. All right, very good. Very, very political. Colonel Cedric Layton, he is a CNN military analyst, security consultant, who has served us both on the Joint Chiefs of Staff as well as the National Security Council. Colonel Layton, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You bet, Dan. See you later, Amy.
Bye. Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Intergalactic love song. Is that Flock of Seagulls?
Yeah.
That's Space Age love song. Space Age. Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Ready?
Nice. Nicely done.
And fly away.
Justin wants a space romance with his new girlfriend.
Yeah.
He had a date.
He did. We're going to be talking about it in the 7 o'clock hour.
He's all grown up now.
Where they met, how it went. Did he give her a good night kiss?
Remember when we used to take him to school?
I know.
And now look at him. Yeah.
He looks like he'd be a Flock of Seagulls fan.
We were talking about the United States Space Command.
Space Force.
Trying to keep a straight face. I mean, it is serious.
It is.
Protecting the satellites and the like, but... It's really the opportunity for us to, do all our drops and make all of our juvenile jokes. Mike in Crown Point, Indiana, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. If you go back, 40, 50 years ago and look at the press clippings and the news tape from back then, you'll see a lot of the same sarcasm, skepticism, and, poking fun at the space program back then, but think of the world, of the impact, it's in, just indirectly of what that program had on the world. We went from, in 9 years, went from absolutely having no idea how to get to the moon to doing it. With the technology available today, the benefits that will result technologically from that investment, I think, are well worth it. And also, Dan and Amy, I just wanted to say, so say we all.
Man, nicely done, Mike. Thanks for that. And I apologize to Neil Armstrong's family.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, for my...
What about Spaceballs?
Prepare ship for light speed.
No, light speed is too slow.
Light speed too slow?
Yes, we're going to have to go right to ludicrous speed.
Ludicrous speed? Sir, we've never gone that fast before. I don't know if the ship can take it.
What's the matter, Colonel Sanders? Chicken?
No.
Get it?
Yeah, Mel Brooks. He's better than that. But that was, you know, it's Rick Moranis' Dark Helmet was pretty good. Yeah, maybe Mel Brooks still... around, still sharp.
Oh, yeah, maybe he could be the colonel.
Could be the head of the United States Space Command.
You know what? I know this sounds weird, and this is a complete chick thing to say. I wonder what their uniforms are going to look like. All right? Okay, I said it.
No, they'd be like jumpsuits with the logo, I would think. But
what color? I mean, are they going to be psychedelic blue?
I don't know.
Women will get pink?
I mean...
maybe some bling bling and the sling sling.
I think, though, we should send Sheila Jackson Lee into space. Sort of monitor, to be a one-woman oversight committee on the United States Space Command. And it would give her the opportunity to see the flag that we planted on Mars.
Oh, that's right.
When astronauts went to Mars, according to Sheila Jackson Lee, to see the Mars rover. She could see the Mars rover then. And the flag that Neil Armstrong
put on Mars. Oh, she's out to space.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5, on AM 560, The Answer.
Today, what? Payday? Mike, Scott, anybody?
Somebody,
somebody's not living paycheck to paycheck.
You can have this conversation with HR offline.
Well, does anybody know?
What?
It is? Oh, it's that. You just heard. Yeah, it's payday today.
Okay.
So thanks for buying Uber Eats.
Yeah. It's the least I could do, apparently. all right. I want to get to.
You kids are expensive.
Bruce Orr's notes on his meeting with Glenn Simpson and. Just the remarkable nature of what we're learning about senior officials at Justice, in addition to the FBI, the behavior we've seen from a former DNI, Michael Hayden, from a former CIA director, John Brennan. You know what's remarkable to me? Not just that they were not playing it straight. They're so bad at this. I mean, Bruce Orr is number 4 at Department of Justice. Is there such a talent deficit there? If they wanted to create a narrative about Russian interference in the election and Trump as the Manchurian candidate for Putin and all that, they've done a terrible job. You would think with the expertise and resources at their disposal, they could perform better than Maxwell Smart. Notes released from Bruce Orr, recounting his meeting with Glenn Simpson, the head of Fusion GPS, who contracted Christopher Steele to cobble together the Trump dossier. Michael Cohen was the go-between from Russia to the Trump campaign. That's what Simpson told Bruce Orr during a December 10th, 2016 meeting. This is after the election, right?
Mm-hmm.
Michael Cohen was the go-between from Russia to the Trump campaign. Yet Simpson acknowledged that most of the information Fusion GPS and British intelligence operative Christopher Steele developed did not come from sources inside Moscow. Much of the collection came from a former Russian intelligence officer, that's a question mark, not entirely clear, who lives in the U.S., according to Orr's notes. Of course, Michael Cohen has repeatedly denied this. They allege that he went to Prague for some meeting. He says he's never been to Prague.
Hmm.
Lanny Davis declined to comment further on Cohen's name being mentioned in Orr's recounting of the meeting. And then this, one notation that stands out, this is John Solomon reporting in The Hill, by the way. One notation that stands out is Simpson's account that he asked Steele to talk with Mother Jones reporter David Korn about their muckraking on Trump and Russia in the final days of the election. Steele worked as an FBI source at the time. The October 31 David Korn story in Mother Jones, just a week before the election, was one of the most definitive to allege possible ties between the Trump campaign and Moscow, creating an important talking point for Democrats in the final days of the campaign. Writes Bruce Orr about this. Glenn asked Christopher Steele, to speak to the Mother Jones reporter. It was Glenn's Hail Mary attempt. Hail Mary attempt. When Glenn Simpson testified before Congress, he said he and Steele acted out of a sense of duty. It was about professional obligations. We're both citizens. You know, we report crimes. People report crimes all the time. The problem is, he also said, I wasn't convinced there was a specific crime that occurred. So why he and Steele went to the press shortly before Election Day with allegations before the FBI completed its work, if this was based in civic duty, and if Steele was still working with the FBI right up through the election? Much of the information attributed to Simpson from Bruce Orr's notes per their December 2016 meeting involved uncorroborated allegations, claims that a computer server in a Russian-owned bank was secretly transmitting messages to the Trump campaign, or that the NRA was secretly taking money from a Russian official. But many of those claims made their way into news accounts anyway. Solomon shares the Bruce Orr's notes with career intelligence professionals. He suggests that they said, and I'm quoting from his piece, they all had the same reaction. The information on face value has the lowest level of credibility. It was second or third hand, they noted, couched with a lot of caveats like may, possibly, and others disagree. The alleged Simpson statement that he went to the media as a Hail Mary stood out to those intelligence professionals as an act of desperation that they would see as weighing against the motives of an intelligence source. I mean, this is just a joke. Byron York on with Laura Ingraham the other night kind of went into some additional detail about this, about why Christopher Steele was flacking for a Russian oligarch that at one time had a business relationship with Paul Manafort, and then that turned into litigation with each one of them accusing the other of stealing. Listen to this. You know, and this is all Paul Manafort, Carter Page, and Michael Cohen. Michael Cohen is not being pursued by Bob Mueller. He kicked that case to the Southern District. Paul Manafort's on trial for alleged crimes related to his business practices, have nothing to do with the Russians. And Carter Page hasn't been charged with anything.
And then today,
it appears that Christopher Steele, when he's writing these emails, is kind of lobbying for Oleg Deripaska, saying, well, he wants to come back to the United States for a meeting, and it looks like he's going to get a visa, and that's a really good thing because we're hearing he's not really a tool of the Kremlin. And it was like he was lobbying on his behalf, and you're thinking, what in the world is going on here? And then these conversations kind of morph at mid-year 2016 into a dossier conversation.
Are you saying you think Oleg Deripaska had something to do with the dossier?
I don't know. He was in contact with Christopher Steele.
Maybe he can have two conversations going on at the same time. I mean, why do they have to be related?
That's entirely possible.
And then York also recounts this other little exchange between Steele and Orr that's noteworthy.
Mid-year 2016, Christopher Steele says to Orr, we need to talk. I need to talk to you about some other business, but I specifically want to discuss with you informally and separately, and it concerns our favorite business tycoon. And now most people who have read this believe that's Donald Trump.
Oh, Trump, of course.
Because that's just a few days before Christopher Steele actually tells the FBI, gives them the first installment of his dossier, which is that famous Moscow hotel room scene.
So Christopher Steele, working for Fusion GPS, as is Bruce Orr's wife, tells Bruce Orr fourth in charge at Justice. Then he wants to talk about our favorite business tycoon in the full blossom of the 2016 campaign. No conflict there.
Oh, no.
That's not problematic.
No. And I'm still upset that when Comey did go to the Trump Tower and speak with President Trump, then candidate Trump, he didn't tell him that the dossier was paid for by the DNC, by Democrats.
It's interesting you raised that.
How would you leave that bit of information out?
Lindsey Graham picked up on that this week, too, and said, well, boy, why didn't the FBI give Trump the same treatment they gave Dianne Feinstein when they informed her that they had concerns that there was a Chinese national that had infiltrated her office and was potentially potentially seeking information to relate back to China, potentially compromising the integrity of her office, intelligence that she may see, and so forth. The FBI informed DIFI about this concern. Why not?
Why not President Trump, or then candidate Trump?
Yeah, candidate for president, nominee for president.
And then in a weird thing, I mean, today, the former Manhattan madam, Kristen Davis, you heard about, she's going to be appearing before Mueller's grand jury. It's just a strange cast of characters. I guess her connection with Roger Stone, but also to see if there's anything involved in Russian meddling.
Yeah,
Manhattan mama or
madam?
Madam, excuse me.
Byron York just tweeted out too. This is interesting. You heard him on Laura Ingraham's show. Uh-huh. He also has written up his reports in WashingtonExaminer.com. He's been one of the key reporters on this saga from the beginning. He tweeted out, emails raise clear question of whether Steele was working with for Russian oligarch Deripaska, who he was referencing in the conversation with Ingraham. Mm-hmm. At the same time, Steele was compiling dossier and whether Justice Department, along with Simpson, Fusion GPS, was part of the project. Twitter sent him a message. We received a complaint regarding your account per this email. But good to know that tweet I just read with a story linked to the Washington Examiner piece of York's reporting, Twitter found not to violate their speech code, and so they will take no action on Byron York's account.
Oh, my goodness.
No, don't worry about the cultural Marxists, folks. No. Bruce in Bloomingdale.
Good morning. You know, looking back on all this that went on for the last 3 or 4 years, I'm surprised the United States wasn't invaded by Liechtenstein. Apparently, our intelligence agencies have been so incompetent as to make Inspector Clouseau look like the sharpest knife in the drawer.
Well, it is a little bit the mouse that roared, right? We could have been taken over by, what was it, New Fenwick or something in that Peter Sellers movie?
This is insane. Is this the best our Ivy League institutions can produce to protect our country?
Thanks for the call, Bruce. Well, agreed. And to the extent that they would rather conspire to prevent a particular candidate from winning a particular election, as I said again, they're terrible at this. They're just awful at this. A few dogged reporters have completely undermined the integrity of these agencies. I mean, just by revealing their conduct, frankly, not in any purposeful way. It wasn't their agenda. Just revealing their conduct. It speaks for itself. And they're terrible at speaking for themselves on the rare occasion when they appear before a congressional committee. How impressed are you today with those who we are supposed to give, we're supposed to default to, that are beyond reproach? Your CIA director, John Brennan, your FBI director, Jim Comey, his senior people, Andy McCabe, Peter Strzok, Bruce Orr at Justice, Rod Rosenstein, frankly, at Justice. How impressed are you with these folks now, a year and a half later?
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
As we're enjoying our McDonald's from Uber Eats, before Ed Burke introduces a ordinance to cap the number of Uber Eat vehicles like de Blasio is doing to Uber and Lyft in New York. New York does it. We'll do it here. McDonald's, the old rock and roll McDonald's, is reopened.
That was one of the fastest turnarounds I've ever seen.
About a year. Yeah.
Less than a year, right?
It was demolished about 13 months ago. It's eco-friendly, don't you know? 1,000 solar panels sitting atop the roof there. Yeah.
It is nice. It's just a complete step up for that neighborhood.
I'd still rather go across the street to Portillo's, but that's me. There's touchscreen kiosks, big 27-foot windows. Now, that doesn't mean that there's any reduction in employment, of course. 100 employee staff to work the new restaurant, plans to hire another 50. The kiosks didn't result in staff reduction. The cashier roles were repurposed as servers and runners for mobile orders and other jobs. Yeah, we'll see if that stands if the city council passes that Fair Work Week ordinance to regulate businesses like McDonald's.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and it's time for another one of our regional home sales slash property tax updates, updating the first 6 months from the first 6 months of home sales around the Chicago metropolitan area in 2018. We've done Lake County. We've done McHenry County. You can get all these stories at newspapers that are the regional newspapers that I started. Or defendhomeowners.com if you want to look up all the data. 2018 property tax report, Kendall County. And by the way, just as an aside, in Kendall County, former Kendall County Republican chairman Terry Pesha passed away recently. He was a friend. Terry and Connie were also listeners, great people in Kendall County. So just condolences to the Pesha family and good people in Kendall County. Best way to do these, or what we're trying to do, is just tell stories and see how they match up to your story, or maybe take a look at your numbers if you haven't in a while, to get a handle on what your story is looking to be if you try and sell your home, or if you think you're going to get a return on the investment you've made in your home. Oswego, the owner of 402 Kent Court, a realtor named Yi Wu Han paid $395,000 in March of 2007. That's $480,000 in today's dollars, so constant 2018 dollars, adjusted for inflation. Four-bedroom, three-bath home in an Oswego cul-de-sac. The asking price on Thursday, August 9th, when Han listed the home, $378,000. Paid $395,000 in March of 2007. His asking price is $17,000 lower nominally. In point of fact, it's $100,000 lower when you adjust for inflation. $100,000 hit in 11 years. While Han's home value fell 21% in 11 years. Good inflation hedge, huh? Not in Illinois. His property tax bill increased 39%. And the two are connected. I say again, please spread the word. Help people make connections. Property tax bill going up, home value going down. There is an inversely proportional relationship. Well, by the way, Han paid $128,000 in property taxes more than during the 11 years he owned the property, more than one-third of what he hopes to get for it. So he lost $100,000 on what he paid for versus what he's selling it while paying $128,000 in property taxes, a third of the ask price in 11 years. So again, your 30-year fixed, he would have paid for his home again at least one time just in property taxes. It's a taking. The median effective property tax rate is 2.95% in Oswego, according to per the home sales in the first 6 months of 2018. Hans, there, the example we've been giving, was a little over 3. Kendall County portion of Aurora, 3.9% of home value. Minooka, 3.3%. Plano, 3.2%. Plainfield, 3.1%. Yorkville, just under 3%. These are all three times the national average. And we're talking about middle-income families here. The median home price for 6 months of the year in the Kane County portion of Aurora, $209,000. Minooka, $186,000. Plano, $150,000. Plainfield, $357,000. Yorkville, $230,000. Oswego, $240,000. Montgomery, $228,000. So I ask the question again: your pension, your job, or your home, which are you going to give up? Which are you going to allow to be liquidated or just straight up taken? Pension, job, or home? I can tell you that almost no matter where you live, ultimately your home will be taken. Your home, the home that you're renting from the government. The stealth mortgage for pensions that you're paying. And if you think this information is leading to spending discipline, despite Illinois being in the worst financial condition of any state in the nation, $130 billion in unfunded pension liabilities, $250 billion in debt. You think it's bailout after bailout, more borrowing on top of borrowing. You know, we're still paying for credit card or still paying for groceries we bought in 1990 because we pay the monthly minimum on our credit cards. That's how we do it in Illinois. And we're now selling blood to keep the lights on. What do I mean? Well, let me tell you about Chicago. Tiny Dancer, who no one wants to admit, but what we've said on this show, reported on this show for years now, Chicago police and fire pension funds are insolvent. They will be unable to pay current beneficiaries in the not-too-distant future. Nobody will admit it, but the numbers tell the story. The math doesn't care what your political affiliation is or what your feelings are. So what's Rahm proposing to do? Borrow $10 billion to plug the city's $30 billion pension, unfunded pension liabilities. $10 billion to plug the $30 billion.
Can you imagine the interest on that?
Well, we've done.
Our rating is so low.
I don't even need to imagine it. This is Rod Blagojevich Redux. This is what Rod Blagojevich did in 2003. $10 billion borrowing scheme to pay down at that time $43 billion in unfunded pension liabilities at the state level. Now that's tripled. And the $10 billion we borrowed 15 years ago, oh, by the way, with the help of big government Republicans in the Senate who are still in charge of units of government today. Kirk Dillard, state senator, voted for the $10 billion Blago borrowing scheme, RTA chairman. Dan Cronin, DuPage County Board Chairman, voted for the $10 billion Blago borrowing scheme. Mm-hmm. You know where that stands? 15 years later?
Yeah.
Triple the unfunded pension liabilities. And Illinoisans paying off that bond sale, because, you know, not paid by the bond fairy, paid by taxpayers. $13.6 billion left in principal and interest to go.
On Blago's?
On Blago's $10 billion borrowing deal from 15 years ago. We still got $13.4 billion to pay. $13.6 billion.
We have to declare bankruptcy. I mean,
well,
we can't.
But, I mean, so this is Blago Redux in the city.
And so Rahm Emanuel wants to do this over again.
Yes, because
kind of a redo.
Because there is no willingness and there is no accountability for not continuing to borrow against tomorrow to pay for yesterday. And what's he proposing to do as the way to get access to the bond markets?
Yeah.
Guarantee future sales tax revenue. Because there's nothing left that's to sell. Skyway, parking meters. So next up, local government shared revenue, personal property replacement taxes, motor fuel taxes. You're going to have to put bondholders ahead of taxpayers and other stakeholders because that's the only way they're going to buy what you're selling, even at Soprano's rates, even with the yield that people are looking for. So it doesn't work, and we're providing marrow to do it. And it's an admission that what we've been saying on this show is true. So Chicago police and firefighters who don't believe what we've been saying and other public sector union members who don't believe that math is real, Rahm's borrowing scheme tells you that the math is real. And he's hoping to win re-election, and the last thing he wants to do is be a mayor when pension beneficiaries are not getting their pension checks in the mail because the funds have capsized. So what do you want to do about it? Oh, Chicago Public Schools? You know, we bailed out Chicago Public Schools last year.
Yeah, to the tune of how much?
Well, $17 billion pension bailout, assuming the unfunded pension liabilities of the Chicago Teachers Union.
Did you say $17 billion?
That's what I said. Oh, yeah.
Billion.
Yep. And
are we using Monopoly money for all this?
We have, of course, CPS that routinely runs billion-dollar operating deficits. Spend, $19,000 per kid? Talking in the against the backdrop of the violent crime in Chicago about the quality of the schools. Talked to State Representative LaShawn Ford about that yesterday. So CPS certainly chastened by their junk-rated status, the financial mismanagement, the abuse scandals, the bailouts that have been required, right? They're going to tighten their belt and start to fly right. Mm-hmm. Their 2019 fiscal budget, they are set to spend 18% more than they spent in 2018. They have increased their overall spending by nearly 20% from 19 to 18 budget years. They added 13% more school administrators and are larding on up to another $1 billion in debt. And let me tell you something, suburbanites, take a look at your school districts, too, because I'll bet you dollars to donuts that most of them are doing the same thing. They're not to the extent of CPS, obviously. That's almost impossible. But they're not rolling back spending. They're not recalibrating salaries and benefit levels. It's full steam ahead. Full steam ahead. The only thing that's in their way, you know, your homes, your jobs, your pensions. And those will be additional marrow that is extracted to finance these guaranteed benefit levels for the political ruling class and all of its real constituents. Don in Bloomingdale, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Dan, every time the mayor does this stuff, the boys down at Mesro, all the bonds traders, are drooling.
Absolutely.
Because they set the interest rate. Last time I think they went to the well, it was 9.5%, and that's what we pay.
That's right. Absolutely right. Thanks for the call, Don. Well, that's the pinstripe patronage. That's part of the constituency of the political ruling class in this state, Republicans and Democrats. Bill in LaSalle County.
Hi, Dan, Amy. I used to live in Oswego from 1987 to 1997. And in 1987, the town was about 3,500 people, according to the sign on the road. Now it's probably about 36,000. In October, I don't know if you know this, they're planning to open a $30 million new police station to replace the one currently across from Fox Bend Golf Course. That's almost $1 million for every 1,000 residents of Oswego. And I think a lot of that is civic envy. They look to the city north of them at Aurora and their big, beautiful police station. But these towns, cities, counties, state, they've got to stop spending money. They don't have.
Well,
when are they going to get it?
When their constituents hold somebody accountable for doing so. Thanks for the call, Bill. I mean, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, go look at the south suburbs. Go look at the Southland.
Oh, it's depressing.
It's devastating. It's a depression.
It's so sad.
But were they the nicest buildings? Or what?
Well, the police station.
Government buildings.
Government buildings.
The village hall, the police station, the school, the schools. Real nice. Real nice. Government-centric society. This is what it begets. You are spare parts for them. Is there any confusion about this? Because if you're confused, please call.
312-642-5600.
Tom in Bolingbrook.
Morning, Dan and Amy. I worked for a local police department in a West Side village, and I got onto the pension board a couple of years ago because I was suspicious of the math, as you say, Dan. You know, just add it up and see how it looked.
Yeah.
And once I was able to actually learn what the state code is and how they do the math, or I should just make up the math at Springfield and try to determine what everyone has to put in, I realized that it is a Ponzi scheme, right down to the definition that Madoff went to jail for. It's exactly the same thing. And so my wife and I, we understand our pension won't be there, just like as a millennial, I understand Social Security won't be there. So we're going to have to make tough decisions. And on top of it all, we send our daughter to private school because our local school is not providing the education we need while I pay $11,000 a year in taxes on a 2,400-square-foot house. Thanks, Dan and Amy.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Thanks for sharing. I mean, that's right there.
You're making me want to move
now. That's just another story. I mean, you know, this is like, oh, scaring people, wanting to make people move. No. I mean, do you want to live in a woozy dream world, or do you just want to confront the, or do you want to confront the reality on the ground? That's the choice. I have yet to hear all of my critics on these topics. I have yet to hear somebody say you're wrong. I have yet to hear somebody say the numbers are wrong. The inevitability of the math is wrong. Nobody says that. What they say is, you know, you're a, you know, conservative hack, or you're ideological, or you don't care about people, or we're working on it, or there's plenty of blame to go around, or we're racist, or we're transphobic, or you know, something.
Democratic Party was founded on being caring.
You're not for the working man, or you want to steal people's pensions, or something that is totally off point, because on the merits of the data and the scams and the implications, there is no other side. There's just willful blindness. David and McCook.
Hey, happy Friday, guys. First of all, when are you going to learn that CPS is for the children?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Secondly, a lot of these people losing their rear ends on their houses. I wish I could say I feel sorry for them, but I don't, because these are the same lemmings keep voting for Democratic leaders in this state.
Some of them. Yeah, thanks for the call, David. Not all, but some. Candace and DuPage.
When I bought my house in Elmhurst, it was $195,000. My property taxes are $5,000. And I realized that's not very expensive compared to all these other people you're talking about, Dan.
Like,
but I know what they were previously. They gave me a break for a few years. And previously they were $7,000 or $8,000. So I know that that's where they're going. So we went online, and, you know, I've been searching for a house in Wisconsin, Indiana. What worries me about Wisconsin is that Scott Walker will get kicked out, and we will be Chicago up in Wisconsin in no time. So when we found houses like ours in Indiana for literally $900 to $1,500 for property taxes, even though that's a very long commute for my husband, that solidified our decision.
Yeah.
Right then and there.
Yeah.
So it'll be Candace
from Indiana. Okay, can I just say one more thing?
Candace from Northwest Indiana.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. What disgusts me about Elmhurst is that it is like a little Chicago, if you know what's going on here. 14 aldermen, really? You should see how nice the fire stations are. There's never any fires here. You know what I mean? Which is why we're going to move to a town instead of a city where there's volunteer policemen and volunteer firemen. I don't believe in these cities. They're a scam.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Candace. It is interesting about, 70% of communities in the nation, volunteer fire departments.
Yeah.
Randy in Elkhorn.
Yeah, so the pensions in Illinois are not taxed. They get a 3% cost of living every year. I do believe that if you compound that over 21 years, you've doubled your pension. I'm pretty sure.
Yeah. Well, right. I mean, look.
I love the people who are retired who are collecting pensions that live in states that have low property taxes.
Well, not only that, but to Randy's point, I mean, the real play here is two things. One is you make more in retirement than you ever did working shortly into your retirement. The Main West principle that we spoke about earlier in the week, that will get everything she put back into her pension back in year three. She retired at 54. She'll be making more than she made
working by the age 65.
To the tune of $7.1 million.
Right? Over the lifetime of her retirement, projected present value, yes. I mean, it's not sustainable. Everybody's nice and everybody's wonderful and everybody likes teachers and first responders and state workers. It is not, you cannot make the math work. And until somebody wants to show me the math that works, that not only digs us out of $130 billion in unfunded liabilities, but provides a sustainable way forward, then you can, you know, call me every name in the book. But the math is coming for you and coming for things you care about, like your home and your job and your pension. That's going to happen. And the problem, of course, is the fundamental political problem here. The real insight that the ruling class crime families gleaned generations ago, they figured out, is that you know how you create loyalty for life? It's not the job. It's the pension. It's the pension. Make the pension too sweet to ever walk away from doing our bidding. That's what they've done. That's the story of Illinois.
Ba la 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 ka-ching.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
You want more than just the headlines? Find out what's going on and what it means with me, Dennis Prager, this morning at 11, right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy's. President Trump made mention of Chicago violence. That generated a reaction from Tiny Dancer. Through a spokesman, Tiny Dancer said Bob Mueller's investigation of Paul Manafort's criminal trial must be getting to the president. But we're too busy working to continue reducing crime with police, community leaders, ministers, and federal prosecutors to pay attention to his musings, according to some flunky named Adam Collins. Yeah.
Oh, that's classic.
You're not paying attention except to respond and working to continue reducing crime with all those stakeholders. How's it going? How's the work going, Adam? Tiny Dancer. Trump blaming bad leadership for Chicago's violence. He's not wrong. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by our friend John Lott Jr. He is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and the author of numerous books, The War on Guns, More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
I presume that you were none too surprised by the spike in violence last weekend. I mean, you know, you don't know when it's coming, but you know it's coming, and it's just a little bit of an exaggeration of what week-in, week-out life is in Chicago.
I mean, Chicago is a mess with regard to fighting crime. I mean, anytime you have arrest rates for people who commit murder at 20%, nationally, the arrest rate for murder is 64%. In Chicago, it's 20%. And for gang violence, it's even lower than that. And so it's not too surprising that if criminals aren't going to be caught for arrest, let alone conviction, you know, at such low rates, that you're going to see more crime occurring. And, you know, when Rahm Emanuel became mayor, it was about 30%. Which was already incredibly low. As I say, nationally, it's almost two-thirds. And this problem in Chicago started at the beginning of Mayor Daley's term. When Mayor Daley took over, the arrest rate was 67%, and it fell pretty much consistently throughout his entire administration, getting down to 30% when Emanuel took over, and now it's fallen by another third.
Rafael Manguel from Manhattan Institute had an interesting piece about Chicago shootings. One of the points he made, I hadn't really thought about with respect to policing, is we've generally talked about in Chicago, the police force isn't big enough. We need more police officers on the streets in these four of the 22 police districts in the city where most of the violent crime is occurring. But he said one of the things is, you know, the less dense areas, like some of those west and south side neighborhoods where you've got a lot of vacant property or vacant homes, the less dense areas, you need more police. And so, you know, kind of having three police congregating on every block on Michigan Avenue as a show of force isn't the highest, best use of the police if you want to make an impact on the violent crime in particular districts. And if you want to also have those that show of force on Michigan Avenue, then you got to hire more police for those other districts.
I mean, well, that's anybody who's looked at this stuff knows that you have to put the police where the crimes are. And one of the things that Manuel did when he became mayor was he closed down the detective bureaus that were in the highest murder rate parts of the city and moved them to relatively well-to-do areas with lower crime rates. Now, I know he had made different promises during the campaign, but it's not a very wise use of police. I mean, the bottom line is that in many ways, it's not so much that they need more police, though obviously that would help. It's using police effectively. So it's, you know, you put, I mean, the detectives are still going to solve crimes in the high crime rate parts of the city, but if you move them so that they have to go and travel 45 minutes or a half hour or more, longer, additional time to get to the crime scenes, that reduces the amount of time that they actually have to solve crimes.
Yeah, but the homicide clearance rate for 2017, only a reported 17% of murders were solved.
Right. No, well, I mean, it's ridiculously low. Right.
Unbelievable.
I mean, there's no major city that has as low of a clearance rate. The number I was using of 20% was for 2016. But, you know, and the thing is, the gangs is the clearance rate for gang murders is even lower.
But they know who they are.
This whole thing snowballs because people don't want to come forward and be witnesses if they don't think anything's going to happen. You know, if the gang member who committed the crime is still going to be out there or quickly be on the street again, what's the point of, you know, of coming forward and trying to be a witness and do the right thing in that case?
Are there lessons to be learned from, say, Bill Bratton's tenure in New York, his philosophy of precision policing with the first focused on kind of crime and disorder enforcement, using technology, CompStat, and creating systems that hinged on accurate intelligence and rapid deployment of resources and follow-up, along with the kind of now famous broken windows policing of making sure law enforcement pays attention to minor infractions because ignoring them exacerbates the underlying cultural problem. Do we need a police leadership like that? Do we need a kind of a completely different strategic approach, something on the order of what Bratton implemented successfully in New York?
Well, I think that's helpful, but the big thing is just the poor use of the police. So you have this agreement, I guess about a year and a half ago or so, that Manuel made with the ACLU with regard to how the forms that police have to fill out every time they go and talk to somebody. It's like they have to spend 45 minutes or an hour filling out this long two-page, very tiny type, legal page length forms, which, you know, so you go, you're a police officer, and you go and you talk to three or four people in the morning, which you would hope they're going to do if they're going to be investigating things or trying to follow up on concerns that people have. Then the rest of the afternoon, they're going out and filling out the stupid forms. And so, you know, it's just this kind of political correctness there that adds really no additional understanding or ability to go and solve crimes. So, I mean, you can go and hire more police. You can put the police where the crimes are, which seems like pretty basic 101 stuff. But you also have to get rid of this kind of political correctness there that's wasting police officers' time. So it's being wasted in terms of travel time by closing down the detective bureaus in the high crime rate parts of the city. It's being wasted by having the stupid paperwork
that they have to go and do. It's just mindless stuff that's there, that's the bureaucracy on down. And again, this is a problem that's been getting worse since the beginning of the Daley administration. And now there's no city in the country that is even close to Chicago in terms of having such a low rate of solving crimes.
And you have candidates for mayor that are mobilizing the populace against the police. That's part of an election strategy, is to run against the police. Well, that, of course, eliminates the police feelings that the civilian political authority has their back, which it doesn't. And then you're creating and fomenting mistrust among populations the police need to work with, and who need to work with police to make their neighborhoods safer.
I mean, look, it makes no sense. I mean, part of the blame for kind of problems between the police and citizens I put on the Obama administration. They were constantly putting out these really poorly done studies claiming systematic discrimination by police departments. Anytime they'd find any disparity, they would immediately claim that it had to do with racism. And I think that has had an impact in terms of the rates that blacks in particular report crimes to police. So you end up with this situation where you're saying you're concerned about certain minority populations, and then you make it so that the minority populations are alienated against the police, and right, they're less likely to report crimes, and that increases crime, and so there are more victims in those areas where you're claiming you're concerned about, because the criminals are even less concerned about being caught and convicted for the crimes, because they know that they're not going to get, the police aren't going to get help from those communities.
And so it goes. He is John Law Jr., president of the Crime Prevention Research Center, the author of books including The War on Guns and More Guns, Less Crime. John, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so the Hollywood left wants you to like them again and pay attention to them. They're revamping the Oscars to make it more interesting for you, they think. First thing they should do is get rid of Jimmy Kimmel.
Well, yeah, because he's alienated half the country. And he's, I'm done with him.
Before he even did that, though, I mean, he's like presided over some of the lowest rated Oscars and like the second lowest rated or third lowest rated Oscars.
But they keep bringing him back.
He sucks.
He's the darling of ABC.
He topped out with Win Ben Stein's money. It's been downhill for him ever since. But here's what they actually are doing. They're expanding the number of best movie categories, best animated feature, best picture, of course, and now outstanding achievement in popular film.
So the blockbuster smash of the summer will probably win.
Yeah, how do you define popular? Raise it by
That's what I was saying, box office sales, or maybe, you know, DVD rental, on demand,
which
or
is,
of them all combined.
Kyle Smith makes the point in National Review, though, where does The Revenant belong? It's an art film, but it earned $500 million. Where does Wes Anderson's Grand Budapest Hotel belong? Popular or just best picture?
Well, could it be in both categories?
Yeah, I mean, it's all just, you know, sophistry. But Mark Stein had a great riff on Stuart Varney yesterday, how this exposes the hypocrisy of Hollywood.
And as you said, Stuart, it's the dishonor. For 11 and a half months of the year, the motion picture business now is like Ant-Man 3, Iron Man 7, Cardboard Man 12, Franchise Man 53. And then for like 3 weeks before the Oscars, it's all suddenly like Oscar bait chick flits, flicks, you know, produced by Harvey Weinstein, oddly enough. And they pretend they're great artists. So it tells the sobering story of a woman growing up in transphobic Manitoba who and you think, wait a minute, I never saw this film. It was Franchise Man 57 when I was at the multiplex. That's all. So that's the thing. It's actually the contradiction between who they pretend to be and what this business model is.
I can't wait to see that sobering tale of the
woman growing up in transphobic Manitoba.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Eva Peron, and Comrade Bernie took it on the shorts a little bit on Tuesday. And so the question becomes, though, since all the energy is with the socialists, Democrat Socialists and the Democrat Socialist Party, you know, when they can't focus in on a specific special election like Ohio 12, will they be able to generate turnout for moderate, more moderate, more establishment Democrats that are going to be keys for victory in terms of Democrat takeover of the House if that is to come to pass? You know, somebody's people focused on the Trump voter. Will the Trump voter turn out for congressional candidates? And Pew Research suggesting nearly one in five Trump voters may be somewhat disillusioned, somewhat chilly with respect to Trump today. And so will that cost Republicans in suburban races and states that are that lean blue or are blue? And will that make the difference for Democrats? What about the socialists? Because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's not going away.
No, and she was trying to, she falsely explained that the American upper middle class, which is the fastest growing class in America, has disappeared. Oh, okay.
So I think that politically, this like upper middle class is probably more moderate. Mm-hmm. But that upper middle class doesn't exist anymore in America. And thanks to the continued deregulation of Wall Street, thanks to the continued gutting of working and middle class people, we need stronger champions. But I don't think that they see exactly how rising income inequality has resulted in a very stark political reality, and it has changed our political landscape. But, you know, their heyday was in the 90s when, like, you know, kids had like Furbies and like parents, you had like soccer moms with like two vans and stuff. Like
Furbies and two vans.
Yeah.
that's a dream.
That's not America anymore.
I mean, she's so.
Can she grow up?
Well, she's so ignorant. But here's the thing. I mean, it's just bizarre. A couple things. One is we don't have classes in this country. We have socioeconomic quintiles, and we have people that move up and down that the socioeconomic ladder all the time. And the data bears that out over time. Number two, Phil Graham had a good piece, former United States Senator from Texas, good piece in the Wall Street Journal yesterday talking about income inequality in America. And it turns out that our Gini coefficient, income, measuring income inequality, is not dissimilar to other G7 nations when you account for all of the government programs that transfer income between Americans. So it's actually Ocasio-Cortez that is spinning myths and propagating envy, because that is, as Churchill said, the features, those are the features of socialism. For more on this topic and the good news that you won't have to worry about your funeral costs under a Ocasio-Cortez culture, we're pleased to be joined by Ramesh Ponnaroo. He is the columnist for Bloomberg, Bloomberg View. He's also senior editor for National Review, and he writes about these topics and many others. Ramesh, thanks for being with us again. Appreciate it.
I'm glad to be on.
So Ocasio-Cortez and Medicare for All, which is being reluctantly adopted as perhaps the lead plank in the Democrat Socialist 2018 platform, even the likes of Bain Capital principal or director Deval Patrick has adopted it.
Yeah, well, it's part of the Democrats' kind of race to the left right now. And I do think it is, in addition to being bad policy, politically risky, because the central fact of healthcare politics for at least 20 years now has been that people don't like the idea of disruption in their health arrangements that's imposed by Washington, D.C. That's usually been a problem for big government proposals. Occasionally, it's been a problem for conservative free market proposals. But, you know, a single-payer plan, Medicare for all, literally means your health insurance is threatened. The health insurance that, you know, scores of millions of people get from their employers, for example, is under threat. You really wonder whether people have thought through the politics of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, just explain, pontificate on that a little bit more.
So, you know, if you remember, when Obama was selling his health care plan in 2009 and 2010, one of the central claims he made was, if you like your health insurance, you can keep your health insurance. Now, this did not turn out to be strictly true, but he at least understood the political problem there, that people didn't want to be told, you know, look, these arrangements that you've made, that you're comfortable with, are all going to be upended because we've got this great plan. Don't worry, it's all going to be wonderful. The problem with single-payer Medicare for all, apart from its cost, which is a huge problem in itself, is that it can't even start making that promise. It has to say from the beginning, look, we've got a better idea. And that is going to be a really, really hard sell with most people, and rightly so.
Why does this debate, though, present a particular problem for conservatives, in your estimation?
So, in a way, it's too politically vulnerable, right? So the problem is that Republicans would like nothing better than to campaign against these socialized medicine ideas and not have to talk about their own proposals to make healthcare more free market and to move away from Obamacare. And the problem is that over time, if you have a sort of a one-sided debate where the left is pushing for its ideas and all that Republicans are doing is batting them down, you slowly lose, right? Because eventually the Democrats have a landslide victory the way they did in 2008, and they get to ratchet the whole system to the left towards socialized medicine. And all Republicans are doing is resisting that. They're not trying to actually make the system more like what conservatives would want. That, I think, is, you know, that's a pretty good setup for Republicans because they can do what they're most comfortable doing, which is resisting the left. And they can make some political gains by talking about the threat of socialism. But over the long run, it means that you lose ground.
With respect to the midterms, because this is all sort of setting up for a discussion of the midterms, I mentioned the Pew Research out about the Trump coalition that elected him in 2016 and kind of where they're categorized at this point, with nearly 1 in 5 expressing some reservations about Trump. And the question sort of becomes, in my mind, will Trump's personality do what Obama's policy choices did, which is turn majorities into minorities? And is that really going to be the basis on which the midterms turn?
Well, it is a risk. Midterm elections are referenda on the president, and they typically, although not always, but typically go against the president just because the opponents of the president are more revved up and the supporters are more complacent. So, you know, even if this president were not sort of going out of his way at some occasions to provoke the other side, that would be the case. But probably Trump has made that a little bit worse for himself and for Republicans. And his numbers are lower than they would be for a normal president presiding over a strong economy. So that's a threat. One thing, though, I would say is just because you were a reluctant Trump supporter, it doesn't mean that you're not a supporter of congressional Republicans.
Right.
Right. I mean, right. You could have a very, very Trump-specific problem or concern. But while basically being a conservative Republican. And the other thing is, look, Trump wouldn't have won the election in the first place without an awful lot of people who were swallowing their doubts or holding their noses to vote for him, given the alternative.
Well, and
the problem right now, though, is there is more enthusiasm on the left side.
Yeah.
There's enthusiasm, but it's also sort of a one big dung show, too, I think, to a lot of people. I mean, just to today, a smattering of what I'm talking about. Wall Street Journal, Democrat Party's new litmus test, gun control. Bill Nelson spinning yarns about Russians have already compromising the Florida electoral system. Yeah. Op-ed writers of the New York Times talking about the Constitution being designed to protect rich people like Donald Trump, and it needs to be changed. The Constitution is not going to be saved. Salon.com, we're at the press the hysteria button point with climate change, in addition to what you hear from Ocasio-Cortez. And it's, I mean, all that cacophony of weirdness, I don't think serves the Democrats, regardless of how enthusiastic the socialists are.
Well, so that's one other question about the fall campaign that's shaping up is, do the Democrats, by overreaching, generate some of that enthusiasm from the Republicans? Because, you know, look, what the Republicans, a lot of Republicans want to sell right now is, we've got a strong economy, tax cuts, deregulation are working, we've got some good court appointments, and all that's great. But that's all reasons to be happy, reasons to be satisfied. And those aren't typically the way that you motivate people to actually come out and vote in a low turnout election, like a midterm election. Grievances, threats, fears, dangers, that's what gets people much more likely to actually go out there and sort of do battle. And the Democrats, I think, are the ones who are providing that kind of impetus for the Republicans right now.
He is Ramesh Ponnaroo, columnist for Bloomberg View, senior editor for National Review. Ramesh, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Some interesting goings on in Florida. We had a couple weeks ago that a guy who went to that gas station convenience store.
Oh, with the alligator?
Yeah, taped shut. Ran around chasing a guy with his taped up alligator. Do you know, want a beer?
Yeah, do you know that he doesn't remember any of that?
Yeah.
But that's how hammered he was?
If I had a nickel. Yeah, I know.
They charged me fine, but I don't remember a darn thing.
Here's another incident that went from a Facebook spat to a physical confrontation. Two Floridians, or friends on Facebook, not anymore, got into such a heated political argument that a 44-year-old Brian Sebring, who is a registered Democrat, packed up his AR-15 and a Glock and drove over to Alex Stevens' home and shot him in the ass and the thigh.
According to this affidavit, the fight on Facebook spilled over into explicit messages and threats being sent by the eventual victim. That appears to have prompted 44-year-old Brian Sebring to show up at the victim's home near Ballast Point and confront him. TPD says Sebring was expecting a fight, so he armed himself with a Glock semi-automatic pistol and an AR-15 carbine. When Sebring got to his Facebook friend's home, officers say the victim charged at Sebring, who then drew his pistol and fired two shots at the victim, hitting him in the thigh and, well, the derriere. Sebring then fled and later turned himself into police. And according to the Florida Division of Elections, Sebring is a registered Democrat in the state, but it is unclear what political topic exactly sparked their argument.
I assume somebody calls somebody by the wrong gender pronoun.
Oh, of course.
And
that's always how it starts.
And those are,
and it never ends well.
Those are shooting words. I will say it's, try and silver lining this story a little bit. It is nice to see a Democrat who's a gun owner.
Yeah, that's true.
I mean, maybe there's hope for Brian. Should we take Brian Sebring's AR-15 and Glock away from him? Actually, probably we should if he's shooting people over Facebook exchanges. So that was going on. Now, in a good news shooting, a happy shooting of sorts.
Did it have a happy ending?
Well,
we don't.
It might have had a happy ending had great-grandma Jean Wilson not intervened. But she sort of stopped the happy ending. This is the Houston woman.
Yeah, we talked about her yesterday.
Right, but we didn't hear from her.
No.
And you want to hear from Jean Wilson explaining what she did when confronted with a masturbating cyclist who tried to break into her home.
Jean Wilson remembers every moment from start to finish.
Pants gapped open, and it just playing with itself, you know. And I said, get away from me, get away from me. I said, leave my house. Don't come up to my door. And that's where he stepped at. That's the last place he stepped. I said, you pull my...
Those are his footsteps,
yes,
right,
ma'am?
There.
I said, you reach for my door, I'm going to shoot you.
Mm-hmm. Put and your hands up. The other hand...
So this guy, he's a known bicyclist masturbator. That sounds really weird.
You can have more than one hobby.
And also, he's no stranger to police because he's been arrested before for streaking, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Just walking around town naked. So then he bikes naked, and then he's a burglar naked, too.
His name is Clarence Johnson.
And we're not making that up. He's 38 years old. But she did not kill him when she fired that shot.
No, and now the story turns.
Yeah, Dan.
She wasn't just frightened because this guy was coming at her. She was also worried because she had children in the house.
He could have hurt my kids. And that's all I got.
Her kids are her disabled grandson she cares for, her 11-year-old great-granddaughter who was inside. Johnson survived. He remains hospitalized from the bullet wound to his stomach. Wilson protected her family, but she takes no pleasure in what happened. She's grateful that her family is safe and that no one died, including the man she says she was forced to shoot.
And thank you, Jesus. Thank you.
We had to go and take a big fun Friday, and now it's all sad because she's a...
Well, it's not sad because she and her kids are safe because of the action she took. So, again, in summary, going to somebody's home to shoot them because you had an argument on Facebook, not a good shoot.
No.
A great-grandma protecting her home and her children from a masturbating cyclist trying to break in, good shoot. You're welcome.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy get some reaction to the shooting in Houston, the great-grandma who shot the masturbating cyclist, who is a repeat offender.
No, a masturbating bicyclist burglar.
Well, yeah.
Because he would rob people. So
you can't just shoot people for masturbating.
Right. Right. I mean,
the burglary.
But
was
he was
key.
Getting closer, and she's like, yeah, stop touching that thing and get away from me, or I'll shoot you. And she did.
Yeah. Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been, sort of, kind of. Sean in Elmwood Park.
Uh-oh. I just want to know, Prof, was the masturbating bicyclist, did he have a helmet on? I want the full mental picture. And nothing brings me joy like those bicyclists with their helmet on.
Yeah.
Safety first.
That's it, like the President of the United States. Very good, although I'm not accusing the president, former president of you know, anything other than being a cyclist.
Okay.
And then the second thing is, leave those clips when the show's over, okay? I got to do Walsh's show tonight. I need clips. You know how I like to prepare. So leave your homework there.
Yeah, all right.
Oh, I'll leave you a copy of my blog.
Just like high school for Sean, copying off other people's work. All right, thanks for the call, Sean.
No, we'll leave all the audio in the vault. That's what we call it, Sean. So you can...
Sean in for Walsh today. Okay, good.
From 5 to 7.
Whatever time that show is,
I'm going to call in. I'm going to be Hillary from Mount Prospect.
All right. Ralph and Rantoul.
Good morning. You know, you don't like hearing about people getting shot. It's a serious thing. But clearly the common denominator and all that is the guy needs his bicycle to be taken away. I don't think you're going to cure him of all his naked escapades because most of the mental hospitals have been shut down But maybe if he can't get around so easily, people of Houston would be protected more from weirdos, crazy people like that.
Yeah. Well, I think Grandmama put a little hitch in his giddy up. Thanks for the call, Ralph. Yeah, so that's good news. NFL.
All right, yeah, so they had the preseason game last night. Two Miami Dolphins players, I don't even care what their names are, took a knee. Another one raised a fist up in his, you know, up to the sky to protest what? We're not really sure, something.
Black police power.
Yeah, black power.
Probably.
A few Jacksonville Jaguars sat in the tunnel and didn't come out. And a few other football players from different teams sat in the locker room, which is fine. If you don't, you know, you don't want to respect our country, don't show your face. But if you're out on the field, stand up and be a man. President Trump did respond.
Did all the male cheerleaders come out and any of them take a knee?
We haven't seen the likes of them yet. I mean, honestly, this, I don't want to go through this again this year, this pregame.
Go through what?
All the who's kneeling, who's standing.
Oh, blah, blah, just don't pay any attention.
And then I have to look at the male cheerleaders. Quickly, President Trump tweeted, yeah. The NFL players are at it again, taking a knee when they should be standing proudly for the national anthem. Numerous players from different teams wanted to show their outrage at something that most of them are unable to define. They make a fortune doing what they love. Be happy. Be cool. A football game the fans are paying so much money to watch and enjoy is no place to protest. Most of that money goes to the players anyway. Find another way to protest. Stand proudly for your national anthem or be suspended without pay.
Oh my gosh. So tiresome. The whole thing is just exhausting. Who cares? Don't pay attention if you don't like it. And the NFL will continue to suffer as the result of the antics of some of the players and the discipline or lack of discipline imposed by owners and by the league. So whatever. The good news is Mitch Trubisky was 2 for 4 for 4 yards. So off firing out of the gate. I think I'm going to take the over in terms of Bears wins this season. I'm going to go over 3. I think that's a 4-win team if it's worth a 1 win.
Wow. Know? Well, yeah. Maybe he wasn't playing because he didn't want to get hurt.
Well, he didn't.
He was on the field, but he wasn't giving 100%, we hope.
Yeah. Okay.
Because it's a preseason game. You don't want to get injured. For no-nothing, dumb preseason game.
Right. The way you don't get injured in an NFL game is to play at half speed and try not to get injured. That's the way you don't get injured. Okay.
That's why I'm a coach.
Yeah. Okay,
I need to brush up on football, though, that's for sure.
Perry and Niles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. If you were serious all the time, you would never hear from me.
Oh, yeah.
No, really. I know why this guy was bicycling in the nude. And once you do that, one thing leads to another. So
what?
He didn't want his pants to get caught in a chain.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yeah,
yeah,
right.
It's so much easier. Thanks for the call.
You know, there's a rubber band for that you can put around your
Roll
that's
them
what
up.
I used to do because I'd had bell bottoms and you put or roll them up. Did you roll yours up?
No, I don't ride a bike.
What about when you were a kid? Didn't you ride with a safety flag on back of your banana seat?
No.
And then you roll up your leg or use a
No, you wear bike
band?
Shorts so you have easy access.
Bike shorts.
You know, so you can do one hand on the handlebars and the other hand, you know.
Well, you rode hands free, right? I'd pop a wheelie and could drive all the way down Kiowa with my eyes pretty.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Where was your other hand?
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
All right, we've got to end the show on a serious note here because Mike Scott has got some breaking news about a shooting involving police officers in Canada. Mike, you were telling us.
It is 4 dead. We've been following it in the newsroom, but now the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Company, and local police are saying two of the dead are police officers, and they may have been targeted as police were searching a square of apartments in the town of Fredericton, which is the provincial capital.
And you said they have a suspect in custody.
They have a suspect in custody as of right now. No word on who that suspect is or nationality or religion in this case. Very crime-free type of city, Fredericton in New Brunswick, although nearby in Moncton a few years ago, they had 3 Royal Canadian Mounted Police officers targeted and killed.
And this comes a few weeks after that shooting in Toronto, which was, you know.
They said it was, he's depressed, Dan.
Nothing to do with terrorism. And then as the facts started coming out, in addition to ISIS taking credit for it, it started to seem like this Pakistani Canadian may have been radicalized.
Yeah, and two people were killed, a 19-year-old woman and then a child. So
the stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.